The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to Richard Penny of Crux Asset Management, one of the UK's finest small and mid-cap investors. So welcome, Richard.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, certainly there's been a lot happening over the last 6 months since we spoke. We've had that March sort of mini banking crisis. We've had AI mania, which has driven the sort of Magnificent Seven to almost stratospheric levels, particularly Nvidia out in the States after their blockbuster Q3 results last night. But equally, we've got sort of like many of the central banks indicating they're going to hold interest rates for higher for longer on the back of sort of like sticky wage inflation. But UK small caps and mid caps, actually, just their valuations haven't really reflected any sort of upturn in sentiment. And they're at sort of all time lows. So putting all that together, and I know this is a difficult question, but what's your sort of outlook for your sort of sweet spot in small cap equities?
Yeah, so UK equities on the whole are lowly priced. And actually, when you net off for participation in tech and that kind of thing, they're also cheap. So the UK is on a P of about 10. The US is on a P of about 20. Obviously, the US includes AI and participations in more growth stocks. UK's only got 1% in growth companies. We have more because we go looking for growth companies and it's more. The US is twice as expensive. You get about an earnings yield, so if you take the profits divided by your purchase price, of about 5% in the US. So maybe putting the money in a bank is a good idea there. But in the UK, you get about 10%. It's P of 10. For every £100 you spend, you get £10 of after-tax profits. You know, 10%, of which half of that you get as a dividend, roughly, maybe a bit less. But the other 5% is going into the business to grow it for the future. Should be pretty well pinned around inflation. And generally, when markets are low and the stock price is low, that's a good time to start from. And to come back to the point about UK mid and small, you can try and rationalize against the economy if you like, but the reality is we know there's been 26 months of outflows in the UK. You know, for global stocks, your Diageos, your Shells, those kind of things, you've got international comparators. People invest internationally, run global funds. The mismatch between those and their international comparators won't get too big. But UK mid and small, really quite bad. A microcap, you know, I think a lot of people maybe that listen to this could be interested. Certainly there's a really big opportunity. I mean, people are incredibly negative, an awful lot of pessimism into share prices. There is bad news, but I think it's more about those 26 months of redemptions. I think, you know, predominantly redemptions, they impact most on the smallest businesses. You know, there's quite a lot of shares that are down a long way, and people do not tend to buy those in bad markets, and they've got redemptions. And that creates real opportunity. It could be, I mean, we don't know exactly when the bottom is, but it could be very similar to like 2020 was. It's been a slow 26 months rather than a sort of really sharp correction. It could be like 99 was poor, 2003, 2008, 2009. The level of pessimism and the amount of bad news building the share prices, you know, that's a pretty good time to be getting involved, because if you're not reflecting a lot of optimism, actually the downside may be limited.
And it's quite I'm with you. If everybody's on one side of the pessimistic boat, then it makes me optimistic, just as a contrarian. But I'm going to ask you another difficult question here, Richard. In terms of those fund manager sort of redemptions, obviously that's been a lead weight on the small and mid-cap space in the UK. But what's going to sort of like be the trigger to turn that? And when is it likely to be hurt? Is it sort of like interest rates peaking and therefore people can start seeing the cost of capital maxing out and then hopefully coming down on the other side? In your sort of like experience, because we've had this similar sort of thing in 07, 08, 09, when small caps came out faster than the large caps. And likewise, during the pandemic, small caps roared, having been absolutely flattened in March of 2020. When would you expect this sort of like the flow of sort of like fund manager redemptions to start turning, just as a sort of like, I know you want to get ahead of it, but just for sort of investors?
Yes, there's several things there. I mean, you never know when a sovereign wealth fund might just decide that the UK at half the valuation of the US is something to throw $500 million at. I mean, that would be nice. A bit like a fairy godmother with a magic wand. But actually, in reality, if we get a slowing of the redemptions, you know, the actual fact of people having to give back couple of million here and there. You know, we've had some fund closures in the UK. We've had fund managers that have had to leave running their funds for publicised reasons. You know, and they are then, you know, obviously flagged as a seller. So just if we get a let up in that selling, you know, I know that most of my sort of colleagues around the market, if they had the money, they'd be, you know, really keen on the valuations they've been buying. But you can't buy if you've got redemptions. But we, you know, we just launched a little small cap fund. We're excited about what we can do with that. But we, you know, we haven't got a wall of money going into the Brooks UK small cap fund. But you know, there is another initiative which actually it is being recognised at a government level. And also the big pension fund providers are sort of lining up to do something as well. Mm-hmm. You know, don't hold your breath for that. It won't be this year, probably won't be next. But you know, this idea that nobody will ever invest in small caps again is just not valid. It felt like that, you know, various points in the last 30 years, but it always comes around. And actually companies take things into their own hands. So at the stock level, you know, if you've got a great US software business and you're of a scale where you can go to NASDAQ, you will go to NASDAQ.
So when it comes to sort of timing, you're sort of like, you're not sure about it. That's the big ticket number, is it?
You can't be sure. If we were sure that the money was coming in, everybody would have piled in and the price would be higher.
Yeah.
And by definition, the bottom of the market is where nobody can quite see the sort of the foothills of the rise on the other side. You know, you're sort of staring across a, we don't quite know what the catalyst is. And everyone's going, we know it's cheap, but what's the catalyst? In the wealth management space, the people that give the types of funds that invest in the market, it was, you know, I'm going generally saying, well, we're fed up of hearing how cheap the UK is. Well, the UK now, having been at a 30% discount, is at a 50% discount. At some point, valuation matters to these clients as well. So,
yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, it's darkest before the dawn, isn't it? And we don't know quite when the dawn is going to happen, but when it does, it might happen quite quickly, particularly in that smaller mid-case space where there's liquidity issues, certainly at the moment. And just in terms of sort of like, you know, putting your chess pieces on the board, and we'll go through some stocks fairly, you know, fairly soon, but what are sort of the key sort of USPs of that sort of like the crux smaller cap and also the special situation? What are the sort of the tenants, your traits that you look for in companies? Obviously, we've got the cheap valuations, but sort of the key sort of like, you know, decision makers that help you decide whether you want to buy or hold or even sell a stock.
So it's an investment fund. So it's, you know, 6 months to 36 months. It's not a trading fund. We will sometimes look through what could be a difficult 3 months. I think there's, you know, all the bad news potentially is in prices anyway. But and actually what I quite like to do is use these difficult markets to buy growth businesses. So there's quite a few businesses that are borderline profitable, you know, got lots of revenue, lots of gross margin. You know, in a lot of cases, those shares have sold off, could be 50%, but some of them are 80 or 90%. Mm. So we're just out there, very selective, very much stock, you know, stock picking. Particularly on the small cap side, I've traditionally had found on a kind of contrarian growth basis. Mm. You know, pretty much every downturn I've found three or four things that have gone up, you know, far more than 100%, they can go up 3 to 5 times. And you know, just mirroring what we're saying about the market, you can tell that cheap, there's always this worry that they could be 10% cheaper next week. Often we're buying off fund managers who frankly don't really care because they were a pound when they bought them and they're trading at 20p. Mm. If they're not going to buy them, they're very happy to sell them. And they're irrelevant to their portfolios.
Yeah, if you can be a distressed sort of buyer, then that's perfect. You know, you buy from a distressed seller. That's what I meant. And
it's great. The only thing is, if it's gone from 100p down to 20p, it can go to 15p. And this has been the experience that people have had in the marketplace. That they've stepped into things that look very cheap, and they keep getting cheaper.
Yeah.
But at some point, they recover. And then, you know, a lot of the private investors, who maybe have, if you can only really afford to have a shorter-term view, suddenly the psychology swings. It swings from fear to greed, and suddenly people are missing out.
Mm. Well, let's go for one of those stocks in sort of technology, which has actually been IPO'd, which is Made Tech. Now, it's a small digitization sort of like a company that helps the public sector sort of like, you know, upscale into the latest technology, improve their productivity, efficiency, which is exactly what they actually want. But I think the shares have actually stumbled over the last sort of like year or so. They've dropped down probably from a quid to about 20p. Because I think some of the public sector has decided to push out some of its projects, et cetera. But it seems to be in a good space. What's your sort of latest view on there for this one? Because it is really, really cheap.
So it's really quite small now. It's about 28 market cap. It's got 8 million cash. It floated at £1.40. People are very excited about its growth profile. It's highly regarded by its clients. Both of those are true. Frankly, it's struggled with the growth that it's had in the business to keep the profits at the right level.
Mm.
But that's why it's gone from 140 down to your 18p. Last seen chief exec buying 800,000 or 900,000, which is, you know, it's enough to buy around drinks. I bet he sold some stock at 140, but you know, his view on the business is it's cheap. It trades at half sales when you know off that cash.
Mm.
And these kind of businesses, it's fundamentally a growth business. They should trade at one sales, which is more, it's closer to twice today's price. But you know, longer term, we probably needed slightly more stability in these central software markets. But you know, things like the drivers, you know, DVLA doing software, these kind of things. You know, I'm sure the management are targeting 100 million and 15% EBITDA would be appropriate for that. That's kind of 3 to 4 year view. So you know, it's had struggles with trading massively in the price. Hold that for 2 or 3 years, you should make a really good return. And it's kind of an each way bet, really, because I'm sure there's people that would happily buy it as well.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, it's the right sort of space. And if the management can't actually deliver or struggle to deliver, then somebody else will. So I'll mop it up, no doubt about it. Now, just shifting gears slightly up the mid-cap or the company scale into FD Technologies. And I know we've chatted about this one before, but this really is a sort of like a picks and shovels play for that AI revolution, given that it does, it's KX Insight seems to do sort of like ultra-fast, real-time, mass data sort of number crunching for the capital markets, but is branching out into other industries as well, and has got that Microsoft, as you mentioned, and the Amazon Web Services as partners. Can you give us a latest view on this one? Because I mean, it just say looking at Nvidia's numbers, I mean, this is a really, really hot area.
It is, I don't think it's widely recognised that it is. I mean, by doing the computation for generative AI models in the software rather than doing it on an NVIDIA device, you can save the need to buy these GPUs. So it is relevant to the debate. And it's a product that is launching, KDB.AI. I mean, it is up there as one of the leading solutions of vector databases. Sounds a bit techie, but... you know, similar companies, I think it's Pinecone, you know, which is a startup, floated a valuation of $750 million. But actually, the vector database piece isn't really in the numbers that we use to compute what this thing is worth. It's two businesses. It's the old FD Technology, which is the consulting business.
Yeah.
200 to 250. In 2 to 3 years' time, we'll probably be worth a market cap, which is $450 million. That business did drive the shares from 40p to £40, you know, some while back in history. But the real thing that's kind of the hidden gem of this is the KX systems. It was always niche. It was always a rather specialist language. Now you can program it in Python and SQL. And this is relevant for the kind of Internet of Things. So for connecting smart meters, I've done that in Poland and Finland, I believe. It's relevant to things like defense markets. But actually, they'll deepen their involvement in into the top 40 banks where they're already present. They were niche, but it will go more wider. That's got about 65 million of ARR. You're probably valuing the historic run rate there at about 3x. You know, your average of these kind of businesses in the US is 6 or 7. But the more saucy ones like this, you know, 10, 15, 20.
Mm.
When it gets to 100 million, which could be 9 to 18 months, you know, it would be relevant potentially to move that to the US. And I know that the management are able to split the business. They fully acknowledge that they will get more value for it if they do split it. And I would hope that within 12 months, we might hear more on that. And that would be a real catalyst for the share price. Because not only is it 65 million ARR, we have not seen the growth from Snowflake, Microsoft, Amazon Web Services yet. Those are just to get going. So not only can we get more multiples of ARR, we will get a lot more ARR.
Yeah.
It should be growing at 25 to 40%.
Yeah.
And it's not really, the way they're managing it is more to a US sort of style, which is grow it incredibly quickly and the profits will come. And the US just can't, the UK just can't live without the US loves that kind of approach. So I expect it to split, expect it to go to America, and you know, the shares, which are what, 16, 17 pounds. Well, in 3 years, you can project it. They are very clearly saying you can get to 200 million in revenue. You pick your multiple of that. The US, a miserable multiple would be 6 times revenue for it.
Yeah.
But the people really go for it and are excited by the vector database, it would be 10 times, you know, it's 4 or 5 times the price. But,
you know, I think the light bulb moment for UK investors will be this year when they actually do start seeing that growth come through for KX Insights, because it looks it just looks a fantastic asset that is going to win with AI.
There's multiple ways to win, because you know Snowflake is 10 to 100 times quicker than that. Snowflake's valued at, it's a bit, I don't know, 17, 20, 30 times revenue. Warren Buffett loves it or something, I don't know. But the other similar companies are huge multiples. You've got the Microsoft relationship. Well, Microsoft are in there with OpenAI, aren't they? They're integrating that into their products. You will need vector databases for that, and maybe some of that, who knows. There's multiple ways that it's going to grow. It's ARR, and that should be really positive for the share price.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Well, just shifting gears again, a bit lower down the cap sector into into CyanConno. Now, this is one that's been around for some time, but now really seems to be sort of like flowering, and it's got a big market share in sort of like narrow band RF sort of smart network, mesh networks out in India. And I think it's got literally over 1 million sort of like devices that it sort of like looks after and has deployed and stuff for sort of like IoT and machine to machine communications and all this sort of stuff, because it's a more rural country. Can you take us through this one? Because I think it's reached a tipping point after such a long time of sort of like sort of sprouting sort of leaves.
Yeah, I mean, for much of the last 10 or 12 years, many people listening might go, oh, I've heard this before. What's changed now is you have a smart meter initiative. So for India, you know, a lot of people, for want of a better word, steal electricity. They put bulldog clips on it and nick it. That means you haven't had the right investment, and it's a major detriment to growth in India. And actually, the power companies are not as profitable as they should be. But putting smart meters in place obviously solved that. That means that regulations in place to make it happen by 25, it won't, it'll take 2 years longer. And there is funding for it, critically. So before, it was a technology that could do it, and now there is a genuine requirement to do it. The tenders are up 200 million meters, they get about 10 to 15 pounds each one. So they're quoting on roughly 2.5 billion quid worth of business. Their win rate's been about 25%. I don't think you see RNSs which say we've won 10 million meters. I think they will get the call off. What they do, as you say, is connect the smart meters into, you know, back to a centralized sort of database.
Yeah.
But you're right, yeah, they've certainly won close to 1 million in the last month or so, and you would expect to see continuous wins. As you say, 2.5 million, it's roughly 30% gross margin on the hardware. But you do build a trading revenue on the software per meter, which will be all margin. It'll take a couple of years to come through.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's brilliant. I'm delighted for them. And it's, the market cap is just less than sort of like, you know, 50 million, et cetera. And as I say, if they can continue winning that market share, and they've been hitting the sort of like 300,000 units and 500,000 unit call-off contracts just recently, and if they can keep that one going and executing those deployments, which is obviously a pretty tough bit as well because it's a huge sort of like supply chain need, then the world is their oyster, so to speak. Now, just turning to sort of like the life sciences healthcare, you again seem to have gone for the sort of picks and shovels play. Let's go for one of them, Cuth, which is a sort of like a mental health sort of flagship, actually, provider in the UK, and has branched out into the US. And it's won an absolutely blockbuster contract in California for $188 million sort of 5-year deal, et cetera, raise some money. But you take us through this one, because it does seem as though this is for America to choose a UK mental health provider to help particularly young kids, for America to choose a British business to do this for them says everything in terms of a highly competitive telemedicine, you know, ecosystem out in the States.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, it was one against 450 companies, some of them incredibly highly valued, and some of them, parts of Google and these kind of things, Google Health. And the reason why is because they've got 15 years of data. They know how to do this interventional mental health for adolescents. And so basically what it is that they can provide content. Initially, of course, it's relatively low touch so people can get help and reassurance from a technological solution rather than therapists who are actually in short supply and pretty expensive. I think it's this sort of real world solution that won in California. But obviously, California is about 40 million people, but there's clearly the rest of the US to go for. They're trialing in Pennsylvania, and there's good reports in the press around that. There's people like Medicaid, which are the insurer for lower incomes. Maybe there could be solutions from things like that. Winning in California is pretty key because it's the first big state to award this software. Clearly, they've got the data from the UK, 15 years data, which you just can't create, and then they will have the technological solution. It's a real lead. It takes them from 20 million and break even to 40 million, and the business now is able to do 15-20% EBITDA. It's valued about twice sales. There's going to be execution because we're tripling the size of the business here, execution to get it to their revenue level. But as and when they get there, expect it to be more highly valued. Expect this referenceability of California to make it far more likely they could win Florida, Texas, Illinois, certainly Pennsylvania, we'd hope for, and these other programs. And then ultimately, I think the valuation potentially can be much higher. I think it can appeal to a lot of people because of its sort of social aspect. It's clearly an unmet need. And the fact that it's won against people globally. And I suppose, at a very top level, there's still good things going on. There's still interesting technology coming out of the UK. Twice sales seems a bit mean, but as they execute, it could be three, four, five times. And unfortunately, ultimately, it probably would get taken over.
And I mean the growth rate's going to be massive, isn't it? Because the US is huge.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think you've got to say that they've got a pretty good likelihood now of winning some of those other states. And it becomes a they're going to be on the short list for many of those things. Other people will win contracts, of course, but having won the California state, you would expect to win other ones.
Another sort of life science company that's sort of made a bit of a breakthrough is Creo Medical, which again has been sort of around for some time, but it's signed a deal with Intuitive Surgical to do sort of electrical surgical devices for their robots, etc., for sort of cancer care. Can you take us through this one? Because it now really does again another one. It's turned a corner because I think it did a fundraise at about 20p and is about over 30 or 34p today.
Yeah. So people love this when it floated, and they liked it because the management team are very creative, inventive people, very good at creating solutions, which is what they've done. It's what they've worked on with Intuitive Surgical, 100 billion plus. Unfortunately, COVID came at the wrong time, so they did run out of money. We got very interested in it. We were always interested in the business, but we didn't engage at float. And they said it's at 250. At 20p, the company was valued at the same level as cash and a distribution business they bought. So paying nothing for the technology. It has had 30 million pounds put in. So this approach of looking at these businesses with interesting technologies, growth prospects, but getting involved in what is a buyer's market at very low prices is where we think we can make really good money. So Creo, I mean, actually, in terms of functionally what it does, it is a better device. So for cutting out cancerous lesions or things like this, it can mean that re-recurrences are 1% rather than typically 15%. And just a recent announcement, one hospital maybe, but 10 grand per procedure cheaper, unless, and actually apparently better. You've got a lot to go after in the UK where they've got the NICE, NICE approval. But also, I mean, it's clearly the value and the growth that it can provide to the likes of the Intuitive Surgical seems to be far beyond the 1% of Intuitive Surgical's magic market cap that it has. So, hopefully there's further to go. It is loss-making. They've got quite a lot of cost in the reduced cost, but, revenue is going to grow nicely. And, it does in one instance, for instance, pancreatic cancer, which was untreatable, you can use their device to do that. And it's going to take time to get all the doctors to learn how to do it, but that is starting to happen. So, you know, that's potentially something that's untreatable that is now treatable.
Yeah, and you'd definitely think that Intuitive Surgical will have a good look at this, because if it gives them a USP for their very expensive robotics, then it builds their moat, doesn't it? So and a sort of market cap of about 120 or 125 mil, it's a drop in the ocean. Now, the last one on this sort of life sciences sector is One Health Group, which I don't think many people have really sort of like cottoned on to, but it does sort of helps the NHS doing sort of like outpatient procedures, hips and knees, and other sort of like, you know, operations, etc. Can you take us through this one?
Yeah, you might not realize, but if you have to have your hip or knees done, you do have a choice. You can demand not to necessarily go to the nearest acute hospital, and One Health provide that. So it's founded by doctors. It's predominantly in Lincolnshire, bits of Yorkshire, Derbyshire, tends to be where there isn't private health provision, and it's grown at 15% to 20%. It's on Aquis, which is why you haven't heard of it. And it's on a peer probably 12 for next year, but it's a steady defensive growth. But the real upside to it is that they hire private hospitals to do these procedures, and that's, you know, quite a lot of the payment they get given away. They are in the process of building a couple of treatment centres that cost about $4 million. But they will deliver a couple of million in profit each.
Right.
And the potential is then that you can roll that out. So they might just get one open at the end of 24. But they've done well, actually. They've hit the numbers, and their timelines on these treatment centres, they're sort of slightly ahead. Not all companies that come to the market do this. Last year, they sort of hit their timelines. But for sort of 25, it's massively changes numbers, and potentially you would have a tripling of profit by internalizing the fees that you are currently paying away to these things. You can fund it because there is an industry that likes funding nursing homes where they rent them back to the providers. They are partnered with somebody who will effectively, they'll pay them $4 or $5 million, and they'll pay them an interest rate on it.
Yeah, okay. So effectively they can get debt finance for the build costs of these in-house facilities.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, it's currently profitable, growing 15-20%, sort of 3 and a bit yield. So we don't have to be unprofitable or recovery or ultra growth on things. It's sort of,
yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the NHS is absolutely swamped, isn't it, with demand for all things outpatient and hips and knees and elective procedures. So it's a colossal market. In fact, I think the last figures were well over 7 million people waiting on lists for operations. So yeah, plenty to go for, particularly for sort of like the bread and butter stuff, not the really complex, which you have to go into sort of like, you know, the major hospitals, but stuff that can go in and out in a day and all this sort of stuff, then it makes perfect sense. And that's what the NHS.
It's the hips and knees, it's the back surgery, aspects of that, the common procedures.
Yeah. Now, one area which is a bit challenged at the moment, and I did know in your sort of like the special situations, is the house builders with Bellway and Vistry, some couple of quite large businesses. Just broadly, what is your view of sort of the house builders? Because they've really taken a knock in terms of their valuations. Most of them trade well below net tangible book, etc. Largely because people are worried that the house build market is going to turn down and house prices are going to fall. But that does seem to be reflected in the prices at the moment.
Yeah, some of that is reflected in prices. I would say these are high conviction on a 3-year view, moderate conviction on 3 to 6 months. I mean,
clearly,
mortgage rates, the lenders were up at 6. They've actually come back off that 6% down at 5.75%, but it's still way higher than it was. There's clearly a bit of a cliff edge for people as their 2-year fixed deals move to the reversionary rate, which is way higher than some people have paid. It's been a go-to name for me. It's one of the great stocks for the last 30 years. It's not the best time for it, but as you say, there's a lot of bad news in the price. We don't know, and we can't call how much volumes will come down and where prices will get down to. That's sort of beyond most of our managers. But, you know, the value in a lot of these sort of recovery-type plays may well be beyond the next 6 and 12 months.
And
at some point, interest rates will come down, you know, probably second half of next year. And Bellway has always delivered well. I mean, they're in the right sort of places, building a new build where people want to buy. But this three is one we own. It's more private rented sector, so housing associations, life insurance companies buying for low incomes to rent off them. So it's more block trades. So the Countryside Properties is the leader in that, alongside the Galliford Tribe business. So it's more defensive than the pure resi. But I mean, Bellway sort of typically would have something like that as a 4% view. We build it back up to a kind of a 1%, and we're just gradually adding it. The asset value at £25. You know, you are factoring in lower volumes. You don't put, there's nothing in that for the land bank, which is pretty big. You don't quite know where house prices goes. The asset value goes down. If house prices are lower from here, then your asset value is going to be lower. But you know, around £20, that kind of level, we would add a little bit. You know, as time goes on into next year, because there'll come a time and suddenly, rather than nobody wanting to own them, everybody wants to own them because they know they're going up. And
I did notice there's a few of the house builders. They're all talking about sort of like institutional money coming in for buy to rent, not just the big blocks, other like blocks of flats, which is the traditional being buy to rent, but into actually, you know, individual properties, your 3-4 bedroom or 2-3-4 bedroom houses, etc. You've had that with Barratt, and you've also got it with Gleeson, and a few others have been talking about new institutional investors coming in.
Yeah, it's attractive to insurance companies. I've worked for an insurance company 15 years. I mean, compared to putting in bonds and things, it's probably a real return. You can put your rents up over time, and you're going to get probably 5 or 6% real assets. It's quite attractive for long term and patient capital.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, let's just move gears again to sort of like the silicon chip area, the designers. We've got quite a sort of like a roster actually in the UK of small areas, but it's been a bit, the industry though has been a sort of two speed this, or certainly the last 12 months. We've had slow, obviously, PC sales and smartphone sales, but with this AI boom, we've got obviously the GPUs with Nvidia, which have gone through the roof, but equally we've also got the sort of like a design consultants, the likes of Broadcom out in the States are seeing sort of 20-25% growth of electronics manufacturers asking them to design specific chips for them. So let's just kick off with a small one you've got, which is Sondrel, which is, I think, came onto the market last year at about 55p. It's slightly up from its IPO price. What's your sort of like view for these guys?
So they floated to go from being a pure design house where they just get paid for designing these application specific chips, of which there is actually more requirement to do that. To take more of the economics. So it costs, they will make investment to have the software and things like that. But then starting from the back end of this year, they should start to get sort of downstream economics. So for their speciality is imaging, a little bit of AI, sort of edge computing and driverless cars. So every year they'll kind of add 1 to 3 chips onto their roster, and they will then kind of reap the benefits of that. So the revenue per employee will go up from kind of 120 grand towards, you know, 7 or 8 years, 800,000 to 900,000, just sort of drops out of what will happen. But we start from the end of 23 to see some of the pure margin coming in from the chips. Funnily enough, when this floated, there's a business called Socionext in Japan that floated, which is one of the ones they referenced as the four comps, comparators who will send off their designs to TSMC in Taiwan, etc. Socionext is a bigger business, but their shares have gone at 5-fold since they floated. As is typical of the UK market, this one has struggled to hold its price, but it just feels like it's a buy it and hold it. Exactly how it trades from on a quarter-to-quarter basis, you know, far more important is where they are in 3 years, and it should be a lot higher. Yeah. And it's the sort of stock that people will fall in love with. But when they floated, it was a time when people have had these redemptions and haven't had money for new things. We had quite a good look at it.
I think it specializes in the small nanometer, don't they, sort of design of chips. So anything really below sort of like 15 nanometers, even down to about 6 or 7. I mean, they're really at the sharp end of this digitization to get high speed chip designs for effectively, you know, your non-standard sort of like, you know, NVIDIA chips. These are things for your specific chips for, you know, maybe Apple or maybe other.
So every couple of years, they sort of take 2 nanometers off the geometry. So it's 5 nanometers, push it to 3. And they're right at the cutting edge of that. It costs you more to do the instruments to do it, but it does mean you're going to have appeal. And they've designed chips for Apple before. I think Tesla and stuff, Cisco and lots of household names. And they're doing a lot in the autonomous driving industry as well.
Good. Okay. Now, again, in that area, we've got CNL Microsystems, which, again, has been around for some time. But the shares does seem to now sort of moving forward. Market cap's about 60, 70 mil. It's a designer of sort of like mixed signal and RF. It's sort of more traditional, I think, of a sort of chip design. Can you take us through this one, the business model and how you see it?
Yeah, I mean, it's very conservatively run. It's sort of a family-run business, quite a big shareholding. It's actually investing in some really interesting stuff around RF, as you said. It's sort of 6 or 7 chips each year. They're designing it. It costs them about $5 million. It's profitable. It's got $22 million of cash and about $7 or $8, maybe $10 million of property. So you can knock that off the EV and make about $3 million of profit. But what's really interesting is some of these 6 or 7 chips, potentially any of them could drop $2 to $3 million to profit. So you know, they weren't all, some of them won't work. They've got really interesting products in low Earth satellites. 5G repeater stations, you know, obviously a growth market. I mean, that could be really significant. You know, they're niche chips and they'll be part of the solution, but for them, they can be really meaningful. And there's a sort of digital radio standard, I think it's called DRM for emerging markets, you know, to introduce digital radio for India, Pakistan, and these kind of areas. Where that chip potentially could be inserted on the radios. Now, do they get designed or don't they get designed? But if they do, it could be seriously incremental. So this whole radio frequency area, which is new, is incremental. The business is trading well. We've yet to see the benefit from some of these sort of satellite-type chips. Seems like the shares, you know, they're kind of twice sales if you X out the property and the cash. Mm-hmm. And it's very high gross margin, sort of 60-odd% gross margin. But it's conservatively run, and you know, there's lots of value there at the minute. There's not a lot of downside, and you've got the optionality around the new areas. So I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, well, they might even help Cyan Connode, aren't they, and their RF chips? Because I think the benefit of RF chips is that it's secure data transfer, but it's also, more importantly, low energy consumption. So it's ideal for sort of like, you know, remote areas that you've got sort of like, you know, in disparate sort of locations, you want to pull data in, don't you, for IoT or whatever like that?
Yeah, I mean, CML traditionally have been kind of radios, PMR, private mobile radio for like police, fire, you know, airports and things. They're kind of, the power consumption is a key part of it. So,
yeah. Good. Okay, now moving on to IQE. Now, again, it's one which has been kicked around for absolutely ages. And I think, it did a fundraise just recently, raised about £30 million at 20p. And I can't remember whether the shares were previously quite, you know, quite high. Market cap's about 170, 180 mil. For layman like me, what is the USP of this business in terms of what it does compared to, you know, sort of other sort of chip designers?
So it is compound semi. So what they are is, rather than pure silicon, it's gallium arsenide, gallium nitride, various combinations of chemicals, which have better power characteristics. So for certain power supplies, they might have reduced power. There's obviously long-term drivers for that. They have always been a bit ahead of the time. Their execution has not always been perfect. It's been really rather cyclical, and it is and has seen... It's an out-and-out recovery play. It's roughly trading at replacement value. At 20p, as you say, the new management upcoming, I think, put one up. The chief exec put £1.5 million into it.
Right.
It's really interesting. If you look back in its trading history, you'll see in 2020, I think the low was 20p, got as high as 60 or 70. 2016, I think it was 18p, the low, which is where we are now. Got as high as 130 or 140. But there is a central markets day. You can look on their website. Management were talking about, I think, tripling revenue, so growing the footprint. Mm. You know, a business that hasn't always done well in the past. You know, we like the new management, think they're good. But the reality here is that the world in chips, silicon chips, it got itself overstocked because it was a supply chain issue. People ordered too many, then end demand went down. The market has been through a huge supply correction. So, you know, this company has not had a good time. This is absolutely recovery stock. But it could go from the naughty step to sort of suddenly the management may well bring in new contracts in new areas for these compound semis. May well deliver against some of this sort of long-term vision of tripling revenues and 10% EBITDA margins. You could see how this could go from the naughty step to sort of almost trophy, well-respected management.
Yeah. I think there's a sort of like a sort of technological shift, isn't there? Particularly in EVs, it's moving from the silicon chips into those garden the compound chips, basically, because it's better power consumption. I mean, electric vehicles just and they consume hundreds of these type of chips, so they should be in a right space at the right time now.
Yeah, things like data centers. I mean, the power consumption is potentially huge. You know, Bitcoin is 1 or 2% of global power consumption, and they, you know, if everybody's on social media all the time, and you know, data centers are a big consumer power, so there may be solutions right now. Semiconductors.
Good. Okay, well, turning a bit closer to home into sort of the UK consumer, we've got Katebox came out with a trading update year end on Monday or Tuesday, I think it was, earlier this week, and they've seen sort of increasing momentum as the consumer has normalized back sort of buying behavior for sort of fresh cream affordable cakes. Can you give us your update on this? Because I know you bought in at a good price, and it's about 160, which is or 150, which is sort of like just below a recent offer they got from River Capital.
Yeah, I don't think they'd sell this side. If the management were to sell it and they own a lot of the shares, it'd be £2.50, £3. So it was opportunistic. I don't think that's sensible. End demand for Katebox has been pretty resilient. You know, on the face of it, it looks like it's a small retailer and there's lots of those around. But actually, what's interesting about this is it's a franchise business.
Mm.
So a franchise business, and you've got great economics because you use the franchisees' capital and you supply in their case, sponge at high margin. And it looks now, because they've got, bakeries, they've opened two since they floated 5 or 6 years ago, I think. And so they've now got three, but you struggle to see how they're going to spend the money. And I think it's highly cash generative. I think the yield on it is north of 5 here. It's probably about 10-15%. They had a few execution issues around governance and things, but, you know, nothing as serious as the market seemed to read into it. Market was probably overly negative. But it looks sort of like it's sort of set pretty fair. And actually, you know, we've seen this over the last year. The consumer has been extraordinarily resilient, far more. I mean, I may be more optimistic than most, but I was quite negative about what consumers would be like going into the start of this year with the gas price and everything. And consumers have held up and spent money. Now, you know, similarly now, we are faced that there might be some of these 2 year fixed mortgages which will input spending, but people are still going to go and buy affordable treats and have birdies. Yeah. They might trade down a bit. But Katebox has been pretty resilient. It's broadening its footprint. They've got a lot of franchisees that will open more. And, you know, as we see them, each time you see them, it seems like the potential to expand what they do into more kiosks around railway stations, these kind of things, or drop into supermarkets.
Yeah.
You know, expand what growth is possible. And, you know, a lot of that should drop through in what is fundamentally, as I say, a franchise operation.
Yeah, and it seems to be a sort of key feature of sort of the crux at you, or the funds that when shares drop sort of like disproportionately on just sentiment wise and go below welfare value, you sort of pick up some shares and then you're prepared to sort of seem to be, you know, ride it out for the longer term or medium to longer term until sort of like things, you know, improve or sentiment improves anyway.
Yeah, I think so. And something like a Katebox, I think there's been around about the market cap it is, which is under 100 million. There's quite often a lot of retail investors.
Yeah.
Sometimes, I mean, there's a lot of brilliant retail investors there, as you know. Sometimes people will sell the bad news, even if it's in the price, and that can be a mistake.
Mm.
And, you know, our assessment of this one was that it wasn't that impaired when the share price fell as perhaps it looked.
Yeah.
We do have the benefit of being able to, you know, readily access management teams. So we meet a management team, you know, a day, so we can talk to them, address their concerns, you know.
Good.
And so actually, yeah, often that's the way is when things sort of start to rise, we might trim them a bit, hang on to the ones on now, maybe buy a few more.
Good. Okay. Now just moving again to another sort of best in class, sort of like consumer stock is XP Factory, experiential sort of like leisure with boom battle bars and escape rooms, I think. And they've been having really strong like for likes. And I think they're reaching a bit of an inflection point this year, turning into profitability. The shares went up quite highly and then have sort of come back, went about 30p. They're trading at about 17 at the moment. Market cap is only 30 mil. What's your sort of latest on this one? Because it is, again, it's a sort of like a hybrid franchise stroke ownership model.
Yeah, the business is doing well. I mean, it's quite common this that you see shares come up with good news, and it was good news.
Mm.
You know, they raised the money at 30p. They've done amazingly well to open all the bars that they said they would. And the escape hunt business is doing pretty well. It's proven to be really resilient as a consumer stock. You know, it's raising that theme that we were saying about resilient consumers. But the share price hasn't made any headway. I think it's just in quite a lot of these sort of penny stocks or sub 100 stocks, sub 200 stocks, it's just blows and people deciding they don't want to own things under a certain size. It's not actually a reflection of fundamentals. I think the thing there is to be the other side. They should certainly get back to the 30p they raised money at. And it feels like towards the end of this year into next year, you could justify quite a lot more than that. It's a younger demographic. And of course, we can look at the consumer and be, you know, broadly neutral and miserable about it. But the reality is that people on lower incomes, minimum wage is up 10%, probably up 6 to 8% next year.
Mm.
Blue collar workers have been getting 7, 8% pay rises. And actually, you and I are probably too old to go into the bars they've got.
I don't know. I might try a bit of axe throwing myself.
I'm sure they're close to throwing me out, but just have a look at it. But, you know, the clientele are 18 to 30, and they don't have mortgages, and they wake up on a Saturday morning, work out if they've got enough money, and they have to go out. And, you know, these are people that weren't able to go out for a couple of years under COVID, so they're going to go out and strut their stuff, I would guess.
Yeah, no, I agree. Okay, we'll just turn it over to Poland and Croatia. We've got DP Poland, which is the Domino's pizza franchise out there. Again, it's one which is a business has struggled for a few years, but now it does seem to have impressive sort of like profit or trading update just recently with like-for-like sales, reasonably, you know, double digits, etc. Can you take us through this one? Because, again, it seems to be now moving from sort of like, you know, losses to profit.
Yeah, I watched Domino's Pizza in the UK. I mean, it was 20, 30 million market cap. It went up 100-fold. I think I might have taken 200 or 300% out of it, but I left plenty on the table along the way in that one.
Yeah.
But the Domino's Pizza, the franchise operation, if it's gone up 100 times in the UK, it's gone up to 70 plus in Australia, Domino's Pizza Enterprises, and the master franchise, the American business, up, I think it's 70 odd times.
Yeah.
From low to high. So Domino's Pizza works, and it works pretty much all around the world. The manager, the chief exec of Domino's Pizza Poland, Niels Gornal now, I think he first worked in a Domino's Pizza when he was 16, bought his first one when he was 21, earned 20 of these things, you know, had some of the best metrics in Australia, which is where he's from. He's one of the most impressive people of the sort of 6,000 or 7,000 company meetings I've done. He's probably in the top 20 or 30, and he clearly knows how to do pizza. So you've got a really good business model. You've got a guy that knows how to do this. You've got a business that wasn't particularly well run, you're right. And you've got a country in Poland that it's a bit smaller than the UK, but you know, incomes are sort of probably only 20 or 30% below where we are here. They've got 100 stores, their own stores, so they're not franchises. So this is kind of what needs to happen. You need to get the metrics up. You're right, that is happening. And Nils knows how to do that. And then you need to create and expand this franchise model where you could go out to sort of 500. And then who knows, could you acquire in Hungary or the Czech Republic or adjacent territories? Well, one thing at a time. They can go from 100 to 500. But it's really that, you know, it's been a great business model. This is a really impressive guy. It's a pretty big opportunity in the marketplace. The bare ingredients are there. It's certainly one to watch. That could go up several fold if they get it moving.
Yeah, I think that's... I mean, I had my first Domino pizza back in 1990 in New York, and I never looked back on them. So, you get your toppings right, and it's a winning formula. Yeah.
If anybody would have bought the shares and hung on to them in Australia, US and the UK would have done very well, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Now, a sort of feature again, as sort of crux has him out, he's backing the, you know, really good management. Now, just turning again to another one, which is Advanced ADVT, which is Vin Murray's sort of like buyout vehicle. And I know we talked about 18 months ago, and it sort of had a view at or looked at sort of buying M&C Saatchi originally, but now has just purchased, I think, 5 software businesses from Capita. Can you do us an update on this one? Because I think it's trading at a slight discount to net assets.
Yeah, they're suspended. It's a reverse takeover. They're suspended at 82p. The NAV is about 96p. They're probably getting 3 or 4p off the cash they've got prior to Capita. They bought Capita incredibly well because Capita disposed of 600 to 700 million of businesses, and this was I think it's 35 to 40 million transaction. They paid a really good price for it. I think they got more value by taking all 5. You know, it's the tail end of the disposals, and you know, the modus operandi of Inver is to acquire well, but to improve what you buy.
Mm.
And anybody can buy lots of businesses that are rubbish but not improve them. But the lady works very, very hard. She's done very well in 3 places before, but also in private equity. It has another 70 million of cash because it was only part of the money that's been deployed. They've got those 12 million shares in Saatchi, probably another 15 million. So I think it's important that they now got this operating business in software. This is fundamentally what Vin Murray does. Before, a cash shell, yeah, it did trade at a discount. I think, including what they paid for Capita, the shares are probably fair value would be kind of 110, but you could see how that would grow. So when they come back, probably early October at 82p, not only should they, if you could buy them at that level, I think that'd be really good. But I think as it goes forward, it will create value. So whatever the asset value is higher than today, it will grow quite nicely. Yeah. And there's also an awful lot of people that made money with Vin Murray whereby they probably wouldn't buy it when it was a cash shell, but now that there's more to sort of get your teeth into, they will. And as time goes by, there will be more of a plausible story that people get enthused about.
Yeah, well, she's certainly got a fantastic track record, no doubt about her, creating shareholder value. So, and it's only a market cap of 100, well, you say it's suspended, but 110 million. And I think you could probably put a zero to that, at least times it by 10 in the fullness of time. And now, just finally, another business, IP Group, that is sort of like a developer of early stage companies. It takes stakes in them, helps those guys sort of bring new technology, life sciences, whether it's software, whether it's other sort of technology to market. It's trading at a huge discount to net tangible, to net assets, etc. But I guess the difficult bit is because it's mainly private stakes in private businesses. It's a difficult one to get your head around an accurate valuation of what its book is.
Yeah, I mean, if all the businesses were quoted and they traded like the previous companies we're talking about, and obviously the price would be down a lot. The NAV in the last month they've talked to us is 126p. The share price is what, 58, 59?
Yeah.
I think it's kind of that 500 or 600 million pound mark. You know, the story around liquidity in venture markets is obviously quite negative. So I think people with redemptions have sort of gone sell. And I think in reality what's happened is some of the funds, the bigger funds that have had quite extensive redemptions may well have owned it and, you know, and just had to sell it. And the buyers haven't been the other side. I mean, this is a common thing that we see. In 2020, we had the same thing around Woodford when the shares were sort of 48, 50p. He unfortunately, Invesco was sellers. And they did very well when one of the businesses took off, which is Oxford Nanopore, which obviously floated in the shares. I think they struggled pretty much. But I would expect the discount to narrow. What's really good is they've got 250 million of funds. So there is a requirement in these businesses to continuously put a bit of money in. And if you don't, then the valuations will go down aggressively. But they have that cash. Oxford Nanopore is obviously listed. They could sell that. I personally would prefer if they did, but that's their choice. But that's probably 15 to 20p of the £1.26
asset. How are they going to close the gap then, that sort of 50% discount to net assets?
Well, they may all sell things from time to time. They haven't the past bought back shares. I suspect it's not really the order of the day at the minute. To buy back shares. I think they'd rather have it to invest in things. There's probably lots of opportunities to buy things. Yeah, probably in a way, the opportunities they have probably mirror what we can do in the microcap market at the minute. You know, buying your Creos, your IQEs, your CMLs, you know, they feel like the wrong price, too cheap.
But, yeah.
IP groups on our special sits, and it does feel like, you know, when there's a bit more interest in the markets, it can quite easily bounce 50, 60%.
Yeah, gotcha.
And it has traded at a significant premium to NAV in the past as well.
Mm. Brilliant. Okay, well, that's a fantastic selection of really good sort of like, you know, growth stocks and value plays and, you know, looking at sort of like opportunities there for investors to run the slide rule over. If somebody wants to invest in the Crux funds, how best to do it, Richard?
Yeah, so we've got two funds really we've been covering today. The special sits funds, we've been going 5 years.
Mm.
It's up nicely. It does very well in recoveries. It's got about a third in the kind of stocks we've been talking about today. Mm. It's got some cyclicals. It does have some of the smaller stakes in the house build. It's got a bit of Shell, a bit of Glencore, a bit of yield to it. That's the TM Crux UK special sits. If you want a pure play on the small cap, which I think potentially is really interesting, if we get a recovery in sentiment, the TM Crux UK smaller companies was launched 1st of November last year. It's up about 67%. I'm actually quite pleased because it's been a brutal market.
Yeah, tell me about it.
But we are geared into, you know, we've got pretty much all the names we've mentioned there. All the names we mentioned today are in the special six, but they're in a bit smaller weighting. It's about 35% of that fund.
Yeah.
But what is it? More like 100% of the Crux UK smaller companies fund.
Brilliant. Okay, well done, Richard, on that performance, and look forward in touching base again in 6 months and see how you're getting on.
Yeah, that's great. No, it's been really good. I think it's you know, the excitement is around the price. I mean, there are going to be some big winners from here, I think.
Mm. Looking forward to it. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.